Welcome. This will be your first argument in the Court of Appeals. It's our second in Las Vegas and our third in the law. Okay, so we're very happy to be here. I hope you are too. Any smiles? Just relax and we're going to make this as important and as effective as we can. This is all still new and exciting to us and we're working really hard. And we really appreciate you being here today. I'm joined by Judge Jerome Tao here to my left. I'm sure you know him. And Judge Abby Silber to my right. I'm sure you know her too. I'm Michael Gibbons. And we are going to proceed today with case number 61775, Frazier v. Drake. This is the time set for their oral argument. And each side has 15 minutes. And the appellant can request time for rebuttal if you want to. Okay. All right, Mr. Goldberg.
Thank you. I would request 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. May it please the Court. Briefly, this is a rear-end motor vehicle accident. Happened midday in a large five-lane street in North Las Vegas, flat street, not hilly. The appellants were stopped for a red light. It was a traffic light. They have an obligation to stop, and they did that. They were there for 10 or 15 seconds. There was no notice that there was going to be an accident. There was no horn blowing, no tire squealing. The first indication of the accident was the rear-end collision by this large 18-wheeler Peterbilt cement truck and trailer. It was a big impact. The appellant's vehicle was pushed 64 feet into the intersection. Their car was totaled. The appellant's Frazier and Keys, respectively, their injuries resulted in over $81,000 in medical bills and $125,000 in medical bills. So it was a big impact. The respondent, Drake, was the driver of the truck that was involved in this accident. He was going 40 to 45 miles an hour at that time as he approached that intersection. He admitted he didn't blow the horn. He didn't try to apply his brakes or steer the truck at all until he finished swatting a bee, and then he looked up, and it was too late to stop at that time. He testified the accident was not his fault, because he ran into what he called a swarm of bees, which was at the street of Craig and Valley, which is a half a mile from the accident site.
So, I'm sorry, counsel, let me just focus. Right, we've read the briefs, we know the facts. Let me just ask you this. I gather from your briefing, and I want to make sure I actually understand the argument, you're not challenging any of the individual sudden emergency instructions that the court gave. Your brief made it sound like you're just challenging the idea of a sudden emergency instruction. Is that right, or am I wrong about that?
Right. We're challenging the sudden emergency instruction under the facts of this case.
But you're not challenging the content. You're just challenging your position is the judge should not have given any of the sudden emergency instructions of any kind. Is that your argument? I just want to make sure we're all on the same page here.
That's correct. He shouldn't have given one, and he gave three. He certainly shouldn't have given three. But the sudden emergency instructions themselves were valid instructions.
Okay.
I agree with that. Drake, again, he said that he came into the swarm of bees, and I want to advise the court that that is misleading because the swarm of bees didn't affect him at all. The bees that were on his grill, his hood, his windshield, these didn't affect him. What affected him, and he testified to, was one bee. That he said he was distracted by one bee, and he says that one bee got in his eye.
Mr. Goldberg, speaking of, I realize that the defense had an expert to counter that. In looking through the briefs here and going back to the district court record, in your opposition to their motion for fees and costs, specifically as to the opposition to the expert witness fees. Your opposition makes some conclusory statements that the 100,000 or so expert witness fees were excessive. Then in reviewing the reply, the defendants explicitly delineate the credentials of the experts. They explain why the experts were necessary at trial. and they explained that the costs were actually incurred. And looking back at those records, I saw the invoices as well, which appear to be the requirements that the Nevada Supreme Court have delineated out of the Cato case. So that said, the court, I would be interested to know why you believe the district court erred in reducing the expert witness fees down to $10,000 an expert, and what factors you believe the district court should consider in awarding an amount of fees pursuant to statutes and also the Cato case.
Well, the court, I think, properly looked at and examined the Beatty factors in the motion. Having done that, the court below determined that the Beatty factors in favor of the plaintiff.
And not attorney's fees, I'm talking about the expert witness fees. Because in this case, I believe, for example, the human factor expert, their fees alone were close to $32,000. And so in your opposition, you have clearly set forth, look, they're excessive. The district court judge agreed with you that they were excessive. And so what you appear to be arguing to this court is that even reducing it to the $10,000 is error by the district court judge. So what factors do you think the district court should consider in determining expert witness fees when they are faced with excessive, perhaps, fees, or what this court called excessive fees?
Well, again, I think the Supreme Court states that you should look at the factors that are decided to make a determination as well or not. There should be an award of attorney's fees or costs at all. And once he makes the...
But I'm asking you to focus on just expert witness fees and whether or not they're reasonable. Here, close to 100,000 were submitted to the court.
Right, because under Chapter 18, the statute says you get your fees, but it's up to 1,500. The fees were over 100,000. The judge reduced it to 10,000 on four of the experts.
That's right. And
so I'm asking, what do you base then your argument that even the judge's pronunciation at 10,000 each expert is error? What would you have this court consider, or what would you have a district court consider as being reasonable expert witness fees?
Now,
you certainly have experts in your case on the other side, and had the verdict been for the plaintiff, certainly you would have submitted more than 1,500. Correct me if I'm wrong, on your expert witness fees. What should the district court consider as far as determining what's reasonable for experts under the statute in Cato?
I don't think we ever reached that. I mean, they averaged five expert witnesses, $21,000 each on the average. And the statute says $1,500. So, I mean, we never reached that. We never argued that point. So, $1,500 probably is too low. I agree. $1,500 in today's world.
Let me ask you a legal question here, because there's a little bit of blurring going on in the briefing and then even down below. There are actually two fee statutes, right? NRS 18.005, which is the prevailing party statute, and NRS 17.1154D1, which is the offer of judgment statute. Technically speaking, there's not a lot of case law on this, but the Beatty factors only apply to one statute. The other statute, the Supreme Court's not said that Beatty applies to it. Now, I'm not even entirely sure, I'm going to ask Mr. Jack this question, what we're talking about here, because down below, when you read the transcript, both statutes were at play, but it seems like one of them has dropped out on appeal. It was mentioned in the briefing, but I'm not even sure one of the statutes is still on appeal here. But what's your position? Are you saying that Beatty should apply to both, Beatty applies to one? What's the statute that's, both were arguing from the district court, but it seems like one of them has dropped out here on appeal. What statute are you relying on?
Well, I'm relying on the NRS 18, in that it says $1,500 should be the maximum fee for an expert. But again, in order, before you reach that, you go through the Beatty factors. If the Beatty factors are in favor of the plaintiff, then that should be a determining thing as to whether or not there should be an award of fees and costs at all.
Well, I think what Judge Tao's indicating under Chapter 17, maybe that's true, but under Chapter 18, it doesn't appear to be the case. But you wanted to talk about the Beatty factors also, how they applied to the attorney's fees. You have a pretty good argument there. Maybe you want to make sure we're absolutely clear on that.
Well, I think, again, with the Beatty factors, the Supreme Court has said the court below should look at the Beatty factors to determine whether or not they should grant the motion for fees and costs.
Well, that kind of goes back to my question. You just told me in response to my question, you rely on Chapter 18, but the Beatty factors only apply to NRS Chapter 17. So what exactly is your argument on NRS 18 then? What did the judge do wrong?
18 talked about maximum fees should be $1,500. And in this case, the court awarded, it says $1,500 unless the court decides otherwise, or gives good cause otherwise. But here, the average expert fee, five experts of the defense, they averaged $21,000. And the court ultimately awarded fees and costs of $144,000, which we think is error because under statute NRS 18, it talked about $1,500 fee and for expert witness fees, and the court allowed much more than that. We never reached a point of what was a reasonable sum for an expert witness. Okay. We argued the $1,500 is what the statute refers to. They were asking an average of $21,000 for each of the five witnesses, and we felt that was excessive.
So I think we've talked enough about these chapter 17 and 18 on the fees because we're under 5 minutes now, so if you want to save some rebuttal time, but you didn't get the chance to finish about the attorney's fees. Should there have been any attorney's fees awarded?
My position is no, there should not have been because of the court's examination and rulings on the Beatty factors were all in favor of the plaintiffs. And then notwithstanding that, the court still awarded somewhat, $144,000 fees and costs.
Okay, so you just want to take Beatty and apply it then also to Chapter 18?
Yes.
Okay. All right, you're at under 4 minutes. Do you want to save any time, or are there any other points you want to make sure you bring up so you can argue those again on rebuttal?
Well, I want to bring up the Postal's decision that we think is actually on all fours with this case as to whether or not there should have been did the court below err in giving a sudden emergency instruction. And in Postal's, the court determined that the Horton looked away, and then when she looked back, then she put herself in a position of peril because of her negligence. And we think here that Drake, when he failed to put his foot on the brake or steer and just let the car, his big truck, go through traffic at 40, 45 miles an hour, and then when he looked up, it was too late. He created the position of peril himself by his own negligence, and the instruction shouldn't have been given.
Is that more of a factual determination rather than a legal? I mean, what wouldn't we be here on the other side if the court had refused to give the defense theory of the case?
Well, maybe that's the difference between, I suppose, Postal's and Jones on each side of the case. But still, even though it's a factual question, the court determined that the Supreme Court determined in Postal's that the court below was in error, and in giving the instruction, the jury was confused, and it ultimately led to a wrong decision.
Okay. All right. Mr. Goldberg, then you'll have 2.5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Jaffe, good morning.
Good morning, Judge Gould. Okay. It's a pleasure to appear before you, and certainly Judges Silver and Tao, it's a pleasure to appear before both of you now as appellate judges. Stephen Jaffe, Paul Jaffe and Clayton for defendants Drake and MS Concrete. May I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes.
May it please this Court, It is our position, and we ask this court to now affirm the verdict of the jury and enforce it and abide by the Supreme Court's prior decision in Poses v. Horton from 2010. There are three factors that are essentially laid out in the Poses court. That is whether Drake encountered an unexpected condition, whether he was suddenly in a position of peril through no negligence of his own, and whether Drake shows that he was otherwise exercising due care, and we believe that we satisfy all of those factors and did so during the course of this case. We believe that the plaintiff's position, or the appellant's position, essentially tries to gerrymander arguments and facts by ignoring evidence in the case at trial, as well as ignoring issues of law presented and stated within POSIS. We also ask, of course, that the court affirm the denial of the new trial and affirm the judgment for costs and fees rendered below. The first thing I think I would like to address is, I believe,
I'd like to address actually the what I asked.
Heather, can I interrupt before we go to the fees issues, just on this particular point?
Yes, sir.
Was there any type of motion in limine to keep out evidence of sudden emergency? Was there a discussion when the trial started? I mean, when did this become the key issue in the trial?
Early on. First off, Your Honor, this was raised as an affirmative defense, so it was stated early on, and the plaintiff knew that we were raising the sudden emergency doctrine. There were two motions for summary judgment heard by Judge Smith. One where we affirmatively moved for summary judgment, which was denied, and another in which the plaintiff moved, and then there was a third motion in limine to give the sudden emergency instructions, which Judge Smith ruled he was going to wait until he heard the evidence at trial.
All right, so this was a key issue then throughout the whole litigation.
Absolutely, and what I would point to the respondent's appendix at page 171, in which Judge Smith specifically stated, at line 21, I'm not prepared to rule that as a matter of law a sudden emergency existed. I think that a jury could make that determination, and then he goes on to make some further commentary along that line. So this was an issue that had been presented from day one. The plaintiff knew that this was our defense from day one, and it was litigated three times before the trial, and then was the central issue during the trial of the case, at least from the defense perspective.
The court has a question as to,
when
reviewing again, going back to the expert witness fees that you submitted, and my review of it looks like close to $100,000 or approximately thereabout for expert witness fees. When the district court reduced those amounts to $10,000 or for each expert, under Giblini versus Clint, and actually just cited off Cato, Justice Cherry mentions that the Supreme Court doesn't like guesstimates as far as fees or costs. In this case, we're talking about costs of expert witness fees. How do you reconcile what occurred here in district court when it's just reduced to a number of $10,000 for each expert? Does that not appear to be a guesstimate by the district court?
I'm concerned that that is the case, Your Honor, but
what factors would you look at if you are the district court and you feel that perhaps fees are excessive? What kind of factors should the district court look at? And I saw that you did delineate many of the factors in your reply to the district court.
And if I may, in answering that, also answer the issues raised by Judge Tao regarding Statute 17 and 18, because I think it sort of all morphs in together. The way I see it is this. Clearly under 17.115, the Beatty factors do apply. Under Title 18, they do not. 18 makes it very clear that it's $1,500 per expert. However, the judge has the discretion to award more if they feel it's appropriate. And at that point,
since you mentioned that question, let me ask the mirror image of the question. I'm not even sure what statute we're talking about because the Beatty factors only apply to Chapter 17.
I agree with that.
But Chapter 17 doesn't talk about expert witness fees. So what's the statute that we're talking about
but
here?
But I think Rule 68 does, and since the offer of judgment was made pursuant to Rule 68 and 17.115, I believe that brings it into play, Your Honor. So I think that we're really talking about both statutes that have to be considered. Under 18, the judge has the discretion to exceed the $1,500. That's just statutory language. We all know that. Under 17 and Rule 68, I believe that the court does have the discretion to go as high as dollar for dollar what was spent since the offer of judgment was made, as long as the court feels that the offer of judgment satisfied the remaining baby factors. And to get back to Judge Silver's point, I think what it comes down to is that you have to look at several different things. You have to look at the credentials of the expert. And here we had a man who had 4 degrees in engineering, as well as was a professor of human factors in Stanford University for 20-some-odd years. He has psychological background and training because of a cross-breeding through his training to take the psychological aspect into the human factor since it's a part of it. He has his doctorate from Stanford University. He was a very well-spoken, articulate expert who has a great deal of experience in the field, 40 or 50 years worth, and he assisted the jury on a significant issue that nobody else was able to comment upon because there was nobody else in there. Plaintiff did not submit a response or a rebuttal expert on the human factors issue. So he was there to assist the jury, and even Judge Smith commented upon that when in some of the post-trial motions and hearings, during arguing jury instructions. I really don't remember precisely where. So I think that those are a number of the factors that can be taken into account.
What did you think then when Judge Smith reduced the fees of two of your experts from over $30,000 to $10,000, and if you had somebody that was so uniquely qualified, and yet you didn't file a cross appeal?
Well, first off, I think that Judge Smith has the discretion to make that determination based on the factors that he sees. What it came down to is we were willing to live with that reduction that he raised rather than file it as a cross appeal, and that's why we're asking that the court at this point affirm the prior ruling.
And you know, previously you mentioned that you were somewhat afraid this could be a guesstimate, and just giving you a hypothetical in reverse, had this been a plaintiff verdict, for example, and this is obviously a PI case, and perhaps some of the witnesses, expert witnesses, had worked on liens. One of the things that Cato talks about is actually incurred. How does a district court make a determination? Had this been hypothetically a verdict for the plaintiff, and they send in invoices for, you know, X amount for the orthopedic surgeons, what factors do you look at as to what's actually incurred, especially in a case where perhaps there are liens involved?
Well, that's such a hot topic in so many other ways, and I've actually got that issue up on appeal at the Supreme Court right now from another trial, amounts billed versus...
what is it? What's that case?
Seastrand versus Quarry is the name of the case. But anyway, that's one of the issues that we're actually raising, and we've raised in other cases in limine, is that the amounts that may actually have been accepted is a better indication of what services are worth in the medical context because of the fact that if a doctor is willing to accept X amount, even though they're billing Y amount, and very candidly, Judge Kadish had previously granted me that an order to that effect in another case that subsequently settled that didn't go to trial, but that I was going to be allowed to question a doctor as to the amount that they may have accepted if they were going to testify that their services were worth X, and I could show that.
That would be in the middle of trial.
Yes.
Okay.
So, I agree that that's a factor. When you're talking about a forensic expert that's in a non-medical situation like we've got here, I think it's a different standard, and that's why you have to look at the credentials and potentially at like experts in the field. So, for example, plaintiff's expert in the case was a trucking safety expert, which is, very candidly, a more common expert than we see than human factors experts, especially when you've got a human factors that was so highly credentialed as Dr. Thompson is.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes, Judge.
The standard of review here, as you know, is abuse of discretion. But on the other hand, when the district judge awards the exact same amount to the experts, $10,000 across the board, regardless of what they billed, regardless of what their field of expertise was, regardless of how important their testimony may have been to the trial, doesn't that suggest that the judge didn't exercise discretion and just picked a number and said everybody's worth $10,000? How could it be that every single expert, regardless of what they billed, was exactly as important to the trial as every other expert?
Well, I certainly, Judge Tao, I see your point, and that is a concern. We have not raised it as a cross issue because we're willing to accept the reductions that were given. Obviously, I realize plaintiff may be concerned about that, as might be Your Honor. However,
so you're willing to accept that?
Accept
I'm just saying, you're doing a plaintiff, and you're going to accept those as fees.
Yes, we will. We're accepting it. Okay. Maybe it was switching. I guess the point is that if it was an arbitrary figure, as opposed to Judge Smith essentially saying, I'm just going to cut the expert fees in half, and rather than apportion them out as this expert $15,000, this one $8,000, this one $12,000, just to say $10,000 across the board as a figure assigned to each, I think it's more indicative of the fact that he really just cut the fees in half from what we're saying.
What about the expert that was $10,800 that was reduced to $10,000? Did you scratch your head and say, where's that $800?
Judge Gibbons, I didn't even think twice about it. I didn't look at it. Like I said, my client was willing to accept what was ordered by Judge Smith, so we didn't think twice about the manner in which it was done.
How do you explain the attorney's fees in light of Judge Smith's analysis under Beatty?
It appeared all the findings went against you, yet the conclusion was granting fees, and every finding went against granting fees.
I guess I'm...
You're willing to accept that one, too, I'm sure.
We're willing to accept it. Yeah. I mean, Judge Smith obviously made the determination that the offers of judgment had to have been valid to make that determination. I realize that some of his commentary was suggestive of the contrary, but ultimately he did accept it. I think that Judge Smith likely felt constrained by the fact that a significant offer was made to the plaintiff, not one that they feel was essentially a valid one, but I think they're looking at it through a jaundiced eye of saying, well, my case was a slam-dunk liability case, so therefore 50 and 75 was unreasonable. When we're sitting here saying, A, no, you're failing to consider the fact that we had defenses we were articulating, and B, you're failing to consider the fact that the jury just told you your case is not worth what you thought it was worth zero, so the 50 and 75 was a gift.
In light of $200,000 in medical specials?
I don't think the medical specials is the barometer when it comes to taking into account a liability defense. And if you've got $500,000 in medical defense, the medical expenses, but you've got a liability case that barely makes it past the sniff test, and there's a $200,000 offer of judgment on it, it's sometimes $200,000 is better than zero, just like $125,000 here would have been better than zero. So I think it comes down to you have to look at the totality of the case as opposed to simply breaking out and parsing out the medical expenses versus the amount that was offered. And in this particular case, $125,000 for these two people would have gone a lot further than the zero that they faced.
From a practical point of view, that's obviously very true and a good point to make. But looking at all of the Beatty factors, does it still work that way?
I believe it does, because when you look into the fact that the time and amount of the offers of judgment, those offers were made very close in time to the trial, about a month, month and a half before the trial. So everything was known about the case. We had already been three times through arguments with Judge Smith where he said it's a question of fact as to what the sudden emergency is going to be and that it's going to be going to the jury. He reiterated that again during the trial, but certainly before those offers of judgment expired, plaintiff knew three times already this sudden emergency was an issue the jury was going to have to face. So I believe that when you look at the timing of those offers and the amount compared against the other factors, they were more than acceptable under the Beatty factors, Judge Gibbons. I don't have much time, but there's a couple of points I would like to make because I think, I forgot exactly who made the particular point about the fact that Judge Smith giving those instructions. One of the things that was not identified in our brief, but I would like to point out, because actually it came to me in another case recently since this matter has been briefed, is that it actually would have been reversible error had Judge Smith not given the sudden emergency instructions. And to that, I reference McCraney versus State, 110 Nevada 250, which is a 1994 decision, several other state opinions, but also a Ninth Circuit opinion.
McCraney was a murder case. McCraney was a murder case.
Yes, but the key is that the Supreme Court stated, failure to instruct the jury on a theory of the case supported by evidence presented is reversible error. and that's at page 255.
What's the federal case you wanted to cite?
U.S. versus Scott, 789 F. 2nd, 795, and it's a 1986 opinion.
And I got to go back to McCraney, because I was peripherally involved in that.
I can give you the page citation.
Where did the second emergency come into McCraney?
Hold on. No. It's for the principle that, not a sudden emergency, that if it's a central part of the case, you must instruct the jury on it, or it's a reversible error.
But wait, in criminal cases, though, a defendant has constitutional rights that you don't have in a tort case.
I agree, but I think I advance this for the central proposition that when a party has a theory of the case supported by evidence, it is reversible error not to instruct. And I think that that's a general statement of law, irrespective of criminal versus civil matters. And page citation on Scott is...
That makes sense. Purpose sudden emergency in Craney.
797, Judge Gale.
What circuit is that?
Ninth Circuit.
Okay. All right, that is your time there, Mr. Jaffe. If you want to take 10 or 20 seconds to make a concluding statement, go ahead.
I would like to thank you, sir. I believe that we meet all the standards of the case, that this was certainly an unexpected condition that was demonstrated both through the testimony of Officer Young as well as plaintiff's expert Cecil Lynn, who called it an unforeseen circumstance. And that's at page AA 342, 115.23 to 116.5. There was a sudden position of peril through no negligence of my client, and that he was otherwise exercising due care. All the facts support that, as does Officer Young's testimony. And again, that the plaintiff is simply ignoring facts by saying, well, the plaintiffs did nothing wrong. Well, of course they didn't do anything wrong, but it's not their conduct that's at issue here. It's my client's. And the simple fact that an accident occurred does not mean somebody had to have been negligent. That's Gunlock, and otherwise what they're essentially advocating is a strict liability standard in any rear-end collision, which the Supreme Court has never gone so far as to state. Thank you,
sir. All right. I appreciate your
time.
Thank
you,
Mr. Jaffe. Thank you.
First, addressing counsel's comments that to not give the instruction would have been error, I would submit that's not true. In Jones versus Viking Freight, that's cited in Posis, that's exactly what happened. They didn't give the instruction in that case because the court felt that the circumstances led to the decedent's death arose as a natural consequence of his own inappropriate conduct. That's what happened here. That is the same thing as in Horton. Horton looked away in Posis versus Horton. Horton looked away, and she looked back, she couldn't stop. Here, Drake, he was involved, all consumed with the bee, letting his vehicle go through traffic, not being driven, brakes not being administered, and then when he looked up, it was too late. So the position of peril that he put himself in was by his own negligence in not stepping on the brakes. Now, we filed our motion in limine because we felt that it wasn't a case for an expert witness. It wasn't a 50.275 case because the question of an insect getting in a cab doesn't require expert testimony to give the jury any scientific or technical knowledge that would help the jury. And what the expert said was that when you're in an emergency situation, like a bee gets in the car, you can only do one activity. So he's justified in not putting on his brakes, not steering his car. But we had three witnesses who said they've had bees in cars, and they put on their brakes, and nothing happened in those cases. So we felt it wasn't a case that they were entitled to an emergency instruction, just like the process situation, and it was error for the court below to give that instruction, and that instruction, especially the three times they gave a jury instruction on emergency instruction, three times, the jury was led to believe that they were being directed to find for the defendant in this case. I think the time is up.
You actually have a few more seconds. The clock didn't get reset on the time I set, so if you want to take 30 seconds to wrap up.
Okay, we just think that the judge below arbitrarily gave these three instructions. He shouldn't have done those instructions, and it was prejudicial to us. The jury was misled and confused, and just as the closest court, it's exactly the same actual factual setting, and we're asking for a new trial because of that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. Thank you both, counsel, for the excellent job. This was very helpful. We always get a much better feeling from the case when we hear from the attorneys that are actually there. So we thank you for your excellent presentation. Sam, I forgot to ask you to introduce your co-counsel, Mr. Jaffe.
Judge, he is Ashley Sir, and what I would like to say is Ms. Sir is on the brief, tried the case with me. She's no longer with my firm, but I asked her to come here today since the victory was as much hers as it was mine. And since she was on the brief, I asked her and checked with the clerk, make sure that she would be able to sit at counsel table with me. Thank you, sir.
Well, welcome. Thank you for attending here today, too. What are you doing now?
Similar stuff, civil defense work, just at a different firm.
Okay.
Thank you for allowing me to be here.
All right, this matter will stand submitted for further deliberation, and the court will be in recess.